Welcome back to the November Learning Podcast Series with Richard Helcott and Alan November. Richard is the Director of Strategy, Research, and Global Education for Cisco Systems. Richard presented at our 2010 Building Learning Communities Conference. If you wish to find out more about the conference, visit novemberlearning.com/BLC. This podcast is part three of a six-part series. In the podcast, Richard Helcott and Alan November discuss the power of informal learning. Their discussion emphasizes the importance of capturing the knowledge of students using personal and collaborative learning. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
The final thing that I wanted to draw out here was what we're increasingly learning about the power of informal learning. And this is very difficult to get a handle on. There's a lot of work going on now to try and capture the importance of informal learning, the way in which people either learn themselves or in groups. One thing we're learning is that just by definition, this must be important. Students spend only 14% of their time in school, and around 60% of their time is actually with parents, friends, and in the community. Some areas are better studied than others, and one of them is the workplace. And we do know that at work, employees learn around 70% of their job from colleagues. They don't learn it from formal training. They don't learn it necessarily from their boss. They learn it from their colleagues, and they learn it ongoing and on the job. So why would we suspect that that isn't similar, or there aren't similar forces to be harnessed to support formal learning in school? We also know in the workplace that every hour of formal training is matched to around 4 hours of informal learning to actually put that into practice, to actually take the formal learning and then apply it to a new problem in a new environment and make sure that the person themselves actually owns that understanding rather than just sort of has it from a textbook point of view. And in school, we're seeing very powerful peer effects. We're seeing the effect of increased skills, literacy, or numeracy in a wider classroom group really influencing individuals within that. And there have been studies that have shown that, you know, if you raise the achievement of a group in a class by a few percent, then people who are associated with that group who didn't receive the teaching intervention also benefit by a smaller percentage, but they also benefit. So the question is how do we harness informal learning, which of course is voluntary? People don't need to do it. So therefore, by definition, it's voluntary, it's authentic, it must be engaging for them. And how do we use it to reduce bottlenecks in the existing system?
You know, I am fascinated by, I've never seen the 70% of employees learning how to do their job from colleagues. And it's a match. The most interesting question I get to ask students when I travel in schools all over the world is, if you don't understand something in a class and you walk out and you're confused and you care about learning, what's your strategy for learning? And overwhelmingly, students say they will go to a friend and ask the friend if they understood. And if they did not actually learn in class, they actually learned in these informal conversations outside of class. And so it seems to me that the opportunity is for schools to max out on students having conversations with one another in a very constructive, creative way. And in fact, there's this incredible website near where you live in Los Angeles of a teacher named Eric Marcos. He's got a great website called MathTraining.tv. We had an earlier podcast with Eric, whose students are designing quick screencast tutorials in mathematics. There are students who've had 4,000 visits to one of their tutorials. I have yet to meet a teacher who's had the same question asked 4,000 times. This kid has answered the question 4,000 times. I'm just intrigued by that. And so the entire value of the most important information in the room currently is the teacher's knowledge. And it sounds like the most important information in the room are the conversations yet to happen between students to make meaning of the knowledge.
I think that's right. And I think that one of the crucial things that we see with that is that teachers, or, you know, in a workplace, managers fail to see the problem in the way that the students do, who are bringing their own understanding to that problem. And with all of its problems, they might have a complete blind spot in a particular area of a problem, and the teacher can't see that because they know the answer. That's, it's sort of, unrecoverably difficult for them to kind of step back to not knowing the answer and finding their way towards it. The other point about peer groups in classrooms is that by definition, they've bonded together over some degree of shared interest or understanding or through a need to interact. So it might be, you know, that if someone's having a problem with a math part of a problem, then they know the person in that class to go to, if they're friends with them or if they're not, but they can ask for that help on that specific part of that question. So I think you're right, Alan, and I think that really changes the way in which we think about classroom dynamics and the way in which, you know, we've got to at least, or certainly instill in the minds of students that learning is collaborative and not competitive. Although, of course, we do know that when it comes to summative evaluation, then there's going to be a competitive element. But as we go along the way, people would learn an awful lot more, an awful lot faster, and everyone would do better if they were more collaborative in the classroom environment.
Well, we'll have to work on that. Obviously, with the social skill set of kids and things like Facebook, they're already voting with their feet, aren't they? That they want to have these collaborative tools when they get home from school. We're just going to have to get over our fear of these tools, of wanting to control and keep them out of school, and figure out how to use them creatively to enhance these informal conversations of kids. Lots of us are sort of promoting that. We just have to get more sophisticated, I think, around the examples we offer people.
I think so, and I fully understand the trepidation of educators when it comes to thinking about open access tools like Facebook and their effect, particularly on younger students and in the educational system. I understand the safety and security concerns, but one thing we can't ignore is you've got to use the devices that students already love in order to get them engaged in these processes. You're going to get a very different level of interaction, if any interaction at all, if we establish a separate social network for school-based learning than if we're able to carve out a piece of a general social network which can then be focused on learning. And I know there are different, you know, e-pals and people like that develop sort of walled garden approach, would be very, very popular in education and actually very popular with students as well as teachers. I understand that. But certainly as you see students get older, it's not tenable, let's take it to an extreme, it's not tenable for a university to have a walled garden because these are adults and they will just go off and do their own thing wherever they want to do it. So where does that bridge happen and how do we allow this progressive blending of private tools with then public tools and making sure that whatever tools the school is using is matching the growth of their students in the out-of-school environment, because we know it's happening anyway. How do we harness that?
There's some work for all of us. Again, very creative, practical solutions. If we can just get over our fear of losing control to these tools.
I understand that fear of control, particularly with the duty of care that goes with it. But I think that, you know, if systems don't bend, then they break, don't they? I certainly don't think there's a way to turn back the clock to say that, you know, students who are in schools shouldn't be doing social networking. They will be doing it anyway. So the point is, how do we reach an accommodation with it?
Yeah, my favorite word these days has become co-opt. How do we co-opt tools like Facebook and Twitter and turn them into rigorous frameworks for designing assignments that are more motivating than we've ever been able to give students before?
Yes.